طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. Old friend and Palestinian rights activist Alice Rothschild has written a wonderful young adult book, a coming-of-age story, named Finding Melody Sullivan, which explores the struggle of coming to grips with the Israel-Palestine conflict of a young woman whose mother is Jewish and father Irish Catholic. A trip to the Middle East challenges her pursuit of identity. This morning we feature Alice Rothschild discussing her book with Mondo Weiss's Phil Weiss.
Hi, Alice.
Hello.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast today, and I wanted to begin by introducing you. The reason that we're talking to you is that you have a new novel out called Finding Melody Sullivan that has a large component of Palestine in it and the American relationship to Palestine and Israel and the American Jewish relationship. So you and I are old friends. We met, I guess, around 15 years ago in Boston when you lived there. Now you're living out west. You are a physician, a retired public health person. You're a filmmaker. Let's see. I have other stuff written down. You have so many chapters. And you're a longtime social justice activist. And now you've written a novel. I believe this is your first novel.
That's right.
Okay.
First novel and first children's book.
Wow. Okay. And I love it. We will get to it in this conversation. I find it extremely charming and challenging. And it's about things I care about, including chiefly, I think, the American lens on Palestine and the American Jewish lens. But let's get to that a little later. And let's start by you tell us. Can you give us a little, not a long biography, autobiography, but of your relationship to this question, how you got engaged on it, and leading to why you are publishing a book about a 16-year-old American half-Jewish girl's response, a visit to Palestine and awakening? It's about Melody Sullivan. This book is about Melody Sullivan's awakening, and right. Which God knows we want a lot of people to have in America. So I've said enough. Alice, please.
Okay. So I was living my life as an obstetrician gynecologist. I was involved in various progressive movements around healthcare reform, women's reproductive freedom, childbirth, those kinds of things. And in the 1990s, I became more interested in my lack of knowledge about Israel-Palestine and the contradictions from my early Zionist upbringing with my adult politics, understanding settler colonialism and imperialism and racism and all the things that we were beginning to really grapple with at that point. And so I got involved with a bunch of other agonized and questioning Jewish people in the Boston area through the Workman's Circle, which is now the Workers' Circle. And as we explored this and listened to the narratives of Palestinians and lefty Israelis, we really wanted to bring this to our community. And so we started doing events, and we were very quickly blacklisted. And then a bunch of us realized we were all in the health field, and we were all actually doctors, and that we could explore this region of the world through the lens of healthcare and human rights. So in 2003, we started organizing health and human rights delegations to the region. I first went in 2004, and then went basically almost annually until the pandemic hit. And so I developed a huge amount of on the ground experience and understanding of the realities in Palestine and also in Israel. And I became more and more obsessed with the idea of writing about this. So this led to my writing three books about health and human rights in Israel-Palestine, about my Jewish journey, about basically what I had learned from the people I was interacting with. And this led to a whole life of speaking engagements and writing in anthologies and all that kind of organizing cultural kind of work. And then in 2016, on a fateful day, I was giving a talk for a bunch of Quakers. And this teacher said to me, "You should write a book for kids about Palestine." And I said, basically, I don't write books for children. I had children of my own. I knew nothing about writing children's books. And that night, I dreamt a picture book. And I woke up and thought, oh, my goodness, there's a picture book in my head. And it was basically modeled after Naomi Shihab Nye's City's Secrets. So I wrote it down and I, you know, started thinking about, well, maybe I could write a picture book. And then I moved to Seattle and kind of realized as I struggled over this that I knew absolutely nothing about writing children's books. So I joined the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, the Pacific Northwest Writers Association. I got into a critique group and I basically developed an unofficial MFA in writing children's books. And the picture book turned into a middle grade novel, which is currently being seriously considered by a publisher. And the rule is that after you finish a book, you need to move on to the next one. Otherwise, you will, you know, die waiting for the first one to get published. So I wrote a graphic novel, which took a whole lot of education on how to do that, about a cat that lives in the Shuafat refugee camp in Jerusalem. And I've been working with various Palestinian graphic artists who, for various complicated, mostly political reasons, have not followed through. But I'm now working with an artist in Gaza, which has its whole other challenges, as you can imagine. But he's a brilliant artist. And we will see if we can pull this one off. There's a publisher also interested in that one.
Great.
And then I wrote this young adult novel. So that's sort of the arc of my children's writing history. And as I did all of this, I became, you know, I started reading what's called kid lit, and I became intensely aware that there's almost no kid lit that has a sympathetic view of Palestine or Palestinian. So that just upped my motivation.
Thank you for that wonderful tour. I want to drill down into a couple things you've said before we get to Finding Melody Sullivan. You began, as I began, in a very parochial Jewish space, or not very, but a parochial Jewish space. And today we find ourselves in a much more diverse cultural space, and we are grateful for that. It's essential to our work and the work of others who care about Palestine. But I want to start in that space with you and ask you a couple questions, just two in that regard. First, what is it about, how would you explain, you know, Jews of our generation, we're roughly the same age, are largely much more pro-Zionist, pro-Israel than you and I are. And so I, and the Holocaust, very important, and Israel's the answer to the Holocaust, the litany. I'm curious about psychologically, characterologically, personally, how you explain, because I have my own answer to this for myself, how you explain that you in the 90s were able to say, gosh, this is a question of social justice and I'm not on Israel's side necessarily. And damn it, I'm not on Israel's side. Okay. How do you explain that you jump the fence, and I jumped the fence. What is it about you that allowed you to reach this understanding when there's so much cultural inhibition and omerta and other forms of repression and that make this a heresy in our community?
Right. So, you know, that's a complicated question. I think that for Jews in our generation, we lost a lot of the attachment to the religion. And so the way to be Jewish in this country was to love Israel. So Israel became the religion. And you know, I don't quite know why I turned out the way I turned out. But, you know, as a physician working with all different kinds of people, all different kinds of populations, as someone who felt that the way I could express my Jewishness was in, you know, tikkun olam, into healing the world, you know, that that was also my doctor job, not only healing patients, that it all came together along with what we learned from the Vietnam War and second wave feminism and all the sort of historical movements that were going on at that time, that it really came to a place where I had to question my love of Israel, because I definitely loved Israel. I mean, I went there when I was 14. It was like the trip of a lifetime. We were back to the homeland, although we never actually wanted to live there. So I had to grapple with this. And I found that storytelling and hearing people's histories was an incredibly powerful mover for me. So just, you know, listening to Palestinians tell their stories, just like this light bulb went off in my brain, like, oh, that's the history. That's the problem. You know, and then it's like all the discordant pieces of the puzzle plunked together. You know, this is not a story of, you know, all these anti-Semitic Arabs trying to kill the Jews. This is about, you know, the impact of Jewish settlers coming into a region that already had people in it and their desire to hold on to their land. And, you know, it suddenly made a tremendous amount of sense for me. So once that clicked, then the rest of the story kind of followed. And it meant that I questioned everything. And I questioned what Jewish leaders said. And I questioned sort of the narrative on Israel. I mean, the other thing is, you know, I've always been an outsider. You know, I was like a smart girl when you were supposed to be dumb. I was, I had brown hair when you were supposed to be blonde. I went to a smart girls' college when you were not supposed to do that. And, you know, people said, you'll never find a husband. You know, I always was on the outside. And so being on the outside of the Jewish community was not a scary position for me. It was actually a pretty comfortable position for
me. Got it.
And then I found this whole other community that totally welcomed me. And it was, you know, lefty Jews, lefty Christians, you know, Palestinians. You know, it was a whole opening to a place where I actually felt like I belonged. Mm-hmm. And that's very powerful. And so I've stayed there.
That's great. Okay. So another two-part question. How, and I'm sort of segueing to your book now, and it's about the audience for your book. There is a, that's the second part of the question. The first part of the question is, as you know, there is often a debate in activist circles about how much we should care about Jews or the Jewish community. And I mean, I don't know. I don't care that much about the debate because I know how much I want to care. I care about the American Jewish community. Although some activists will say they're very conservative / reactionary on this matter, Zionism by and large, and forget about them, organize a larger community and they'll come along and left-leaning Jews will come along in whenever, just when people are ready to deal with this issue, let them just join our group and are this movement. And, you know, when people are expressing hidebound and ugly attitudes about Palestine, just sort of ignore them or fight them. But, you know, just don't put your energy into it. I put my energy into it for whatever reason. This isn't about me. So my question is, who is your audience for this book and how much do you care about the American Jewish community?
So, this book is a stealth Palestine book, like Finding Melody Sullivan. You wouldn't know. It's a book actually where Palestine is a character in the book. Mm-hmm. So my audience is actually young adults, kids 15 to 85. And it wasn't geared towards the American Jewish youth or Jewish community, but I wanted it to be accessible to American Jews or to people who felt like they had to, you know, hang in there with American Jews. And I also want to make it clear that American Jews are a very heterogeneous community. And so it's a bit dangerous to have one word for all the different opinions that we have in our community. So that's why I had Melody have a Jewish mother. So she's technically Jewish, but a Catholic father, but to be secular, which is really where a lot of kids are these days. You know, mixed marriages are extremely common, and you know, growing up without significant religion is extremely common. But I also had this Jewish character, the Aaron, the boy, who is, you know, wants to be a rabbi, wears a kippah, you know, he's very involved in his temple. I wanted to have him there so people could find someone they could attach to if they were that person. So I wanted people to attach to him if that's what they were, and then follow his journey along with Melody and her friend, Yasmina. So, you know, I tried to play it so that different voices were present so that people could see themselves as they needed to in the book. I would love for this book to be, you know, reading in young adult groups and temples, etc. You know, I have had a long experience of not being that welcomed in most temples. You know, there are Reconstructionist temples, Okavuras, that will sometimes take the plunge and let me actually speak, but it's pretty rare. So I don't feel that welcome there. But I'm always trying, and I'm always, you know, nudging people who have rabbis that they can talk to say, gee, could I come and do my thing? But it's very interesting when I do, you know, I make rabbis incredibly nervous as a general rule. You know, I've had people just, you know, falling over themselves, trying to negate everything that I'm saying. It's a difficult place for me to be, but I certainly welcome being there. And that's why Aaron is in the book. I mean, one of the many reasons. Mm-hmm.
You said a lot that I want to ask you about. Before we get to Aaron and Melody and Yasmina and Melody's father, too, and her late mother, what can you make that a little bit real about those rabbis falling over themselves to negate everything you've said? I would find that a very uncomfortable place to be. Can you tell me how many times you've been in that type of situation and how you conduct yourself in those forums?
You know, it's probably over the past 25 years, maybe, I don't know, 10 times, 15
Great.
Times.
Okay.
You know, but I'll give you an example. We were, this was when I was, I did a lot of talks with people about health and human rights because we felt like you may be fighting over Zionism, but I'm sure you don't think women should deliver at checkpoints. You know, I felt like this is a place where we could have a conversation. Yeah. And then we say, gee, why is this woman delivering at a checkpoint? Duh. So we were doing one of those talks and the rabbi, this was a Reconstructionist temple in the Boston area. And the rabbi got up to introduce us and she said, and we always remember that we have this conversation out of a love of Zion. And I was like, huh? You know, I am not having this conversation out of a love of Zion. Mm-hmm. I'm having this conversation out of a love of social justice. And I hope Jews are going to be positive in this regard. Uh-huh. So that for me really crystallized how we were coming at it from very different places.
Wow.
It was very powerful. I mean, I still remember her saying this and I'm like, oh my God, what do I say after that? You know?
Uh-huh. Were you confrontational or did you let that one pass?
Well, first of all, I'm never confrontational.
Okay.
That's part of my deal. I talk strong with a soft voice.
You
so
do.
The more controversial I am, the softer and gentler my tone.
Wow.
Because
beautiful.
I am not interested in having a fight with someone.
Wow.
Fighting is not.
Wow.
You know, it's not something I will do because I don't think people's ears are open when they're screaming.
Wow. If only I could have channeled you on a million times in my life. Go on. Sorry.
So, you know, it's like, so she was then very upset because we showed a map and I don't remember, you know, there was something with the map. And so, you know, I took a very deep breath and, you know, continued explaining, you know, what I'd seen personally, what people told me personally. You know, I retreat back into, this is what I saw. This is what I heard. This is the experience of Mahmoud who blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Because it's very hard to fight over a personal experience. So that's sort of my strategy in that kind of setting. And it gets, you know, people get very upset because they feel like, well, that can't possibly be right. Or that's one good Palestinian you've ever met or, you know, whatever the context is. So that's sort of my strategy.
I'm impressed by that. And, you know, I want to say that, you know, while we're speaking personally, I think that your parents deserve some credit for your strength and independence, and that if for all the anguish it might have given your mother,
I'm a lot like my mother. I mean, she was a public speaker.
I see. Okay.
But we had our differences. Yes.
Okay.
I do give them credit. They sent me to a good school. You know, they raised a fighter. So
birth order.
First. I'm a classic first child.
Of
of, well, there were four, but there's one died shortly after birth. So there are three.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
And I should just say that with the fighting question, if someone is that angry, they're not going to change. Just like, you know, I wouldn't go to a talk by Dershowitz because he's not going to change my mind. So if someone is that dug in, forget it. They're not my audience. I'm interested in the edges. I'm interested in their children and their grandchildren.
Wow.
I'm interested in the people who are squirming. I'm not interested in someone who says, I know I'm right. Because, you know, that's okay. They've got their opinion. And, you know, we'll move on and we'll deal with someone else. So I don't have to win. I just have to have people listen. And that's a very good way to deal with controversy, I think.
Wow. Wow. Wisdom. Wisdom that I've ignored all my life until now.
Well, it's never too late.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, Alice, let's talk about the book for a little bit.
Okay.
And then get back to larger questions that the book reflects. So, I'm going to dig into the interior life of this book for a moment and ask you about how your decision making around it and that kind of thing. And I'm not finished the book yet. I'm 2/3 the way through, I think, at this point. So
lots of exciting things are going to happen.
I can see that on the horizon. I can see it. The storm clouds have gathered.
Yes.
This book is about a 16-year-old girl from the Boston area named Melody Sullivan, whose mother has died of cancer, I think, around
breast
a year
cancer.
Before. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay.
Breast
a
cancer,
year
yeah.
A year before the book the story begins, and whose father is Irish, I guess, of Irish extraction, and an anthropologist or
archaeologist.
Sorry. Who is going over to toward the beginning of the book is going over to Jerusalem to do studies that he has long been.
He's delivering a paper at a conference. Yeah.
Okay. And did I see the word drag somewhere? He drags Melody.
He's a kind of guy who's like actually quite lost in his own grief and not, as Melody says, didn't get the parenting memo, you know. So he hasn't been really able to parent her that well after the death of the mother. So he sees this trip as this like big opportunity to have some bonding experience with his alienated, depressed, angsty teenage daughter. Mm. So he does drag her along, and she's like, she would rather, you know, go to the moon than go anywhere with her father. And the idea of going on a trip just with him to some, you know, foreign place she knows nothing about and has no interest in is really low on her list of things to do. So he did drag her along. Yeah. So she's hostile.
You know, thank you.
In a teenage kind of way.
Thank you. And she is exhibiting certain behaviors. I mean, quite a part of the life of this book. It's a rich book about that really is made for me. The pleasure of the book is the main character, Melody Sullivan. She's, you know, I didn't really want to read YA stuff. I was going to send you a note saying, you know, I don't know that I can read YA stuff. I'm just, you know, she's a very compelling and charming character, and she's flawed. She's ignorant. She's done some self-cutting in her anguish and depression. She has been in therapy. She is, and yet it's her journey we're following of awakening. And so some of the places that Melody goes, and it begins, the book really begins in this kind of triangle of social triangle that she exists in of her friend Yasmina, who lives in who has family in occupied in Boston. Yasmina and Aaron.
Actually in Vermont, but that's okay.
Oh, they're in Vermont when that at the cat that
That's a college town in Vermont.
Oh, right. That's why she's saying I'm from Vermont. Sorry. I got that wrong.
Okay. There are a lot of nice little colleges with, you know, places like the Buttered Biscuit.
I like that. I was saying okay. It begins in a cafe called the Buttered Biscuit. Or a restaurant. Anyway, Yasmina has family in Hebron and can't really explain who she is to Melody toward the beginning of the book.
Chooses not to explain, yeah.
Okay. And Aaron, on the other hand, is much more open about his identity as this religious Jew. And Aaron sort of accompanies Melody on the trip in that she is often texting Aaron from over there, and he is floored and by the idea that she would go anywhere near Arabs. There is, in addition to that, I'm just going to throw a lot of the plot out that I've been in so far, which I find compelling. She has cousins, as so many Jews do. She has family in Israel. And I believe in this case, it's her cousin Malka and her brother who live in Tel Aviv. And Malka's brother is in the Israeli Defense Forces. Yeah. And he has a roommate who's in the Israeli Defense Forces. And there's a very unpleasant encounter with these soldiers, swaggering, sort of pot-smoking soldiers in their Tel Aviv apartment. But what I'm getting right now is that this person who doesn't really think much about Israel and Palestine, Melody Sullivan, has been thrust into this very political situation. And I'm at a point in the book where she has crossed a checkpoint in order to visit Yasmina. She's crossed a checkpoint into Bethlehem and then is going to travel by car onto Hebron, is already encountering settlers. And Aaron, meanwhile, is talking about Kiryat Arba, which is a religious settlement in Hebron. So
where his cousin lives, right?
Oh, his cousin lives. Okay, so we are getting this character, this sort of innocent American of 16 years old who is being plunged into the conflict. So I've set it up in that fashion. Can you tell me what I've gotten wrong, how you would – and why you chose to do – to frame the book in this, I mean, it seems obvious as we talk about it, but what your choices were with respect to this plot?
So, I mean, that is largely much of the plot. She's had this traumatic experience and just in a teenage frenzy decides she's going to figure out how to get to Yasmina because she didn't understand that Yasmina couldn't just hop on a bus and come meet her in Jerusalem. So that was her first big shock. I mean, this book is about trauma, personal as well as political. And part of the arc, I wanted each character to have an important arc. So her arc is partly becoming aware that she's not the only person carrying trauma and woundedness and to suddenly Wow. become aware of the world outside of her.
Wow.
And so the way that happens is that the journey from the Bethlehem checkpoint, which is this big, awful military terminal, to Hebron, which she didn't have any understanding would take so long, is narrated by this woman on the bus, the taxi driver. These are people who are just living there who say, this is what you're seeing and this is what you're seeing. And let me explain this. And meanwhile, you're hearing her process it from her, American teenage, oh, my God, am I being kidnapped? Oh, my God, they're giving me coffee, kind of way. And also it allows the Palestinian characters to show some of their trauma and also to show some of their strengths. And also to be the narrator as she looks out the window and, what's that and what's that and what's that? Because you could drive through the West Bank and if you don't translate that thing on the hill is a settlement and that barefoot kid is at a refugee camp and, mm-hmm. This checkpoint is here because blah, blah, blah. You need a translator. So
yes.
For me, having her being in the taxi and being in the bus gave me the opportunity, which I also had as a person traveling in the West Bank. I had translators who just, happened to be the taxi driver, just explaining everything. And of course, I was asking, but that's how yes. I learned about Palestine, was listening mm-hmm. to people. Taxi drivers were a big source of information. So
yes.
it felt right to me that for her, the first interpreter of the environment were the people getting her to Hebron. And then when she got to Hebron, she meets this, multi-generational, overwhelming Palestinian family. Mm-hmm. And so part of her arc is she didn't, people talk about when you write a novel, what is the want of the main character? And the want of the main character is not only what they think they want, but what they don't know they want. And what she didn't know she wanted was a loving family that would just embrace her, warts and all, and, feed her until she was about to pop and, love her to bits. And so that's what she gets when she goes there. So it's an interesting, you know, and then having her be in this family, you know, she's cooking with them, she's making tomato sauce with them, you know, she's playing music with them. You know, she's doing things that people do. So I get to talk about Palestinian life, but it's not, we will now learn about Palestinian life. It's like, this is all part of the story. So I love the way, you know, I learned about Palestine through storytelling, and now I can share my knowledge of Palestine with people who don't know that they don't know about it and need to know about it through just a good story. You know, and a good story involves really making people care about the characters, have all sorts of terrible things happen to them, and then have some kind of resolution. And nice thing about, you know, middle grade novels, you have to have a happy ending. Young adult novels, you can have a complicated, difficult ending. So that's why partly one of the many reasons it had to be a young adult novel, because there's not an easy ending. There's everybody moves from where they are to where they get to, and then they have to keep working, you know. So that's what I liked about that style.
Wow, great. And remind me, the book that's unpublished, you have an earlier book that is that, that's, that you have The Cat in Shuhada, Refugee
Camp. That's the graphic novel, and then there's a middle grade. There's a middle grade novel that's hoping to find a home.
Right? And middle grade means younger than?
Yeah, 7 to 12.
I see. Okay. Okay.
And you can't have, you know, you can't have sex, you can't have swearing. I mean, there are all sorts of rules about middle grade novels.
Okay.
So it had to be a book that didn't have those things. Whereas a young adult, you know, all hell breaks loose and that's fine.
Got it.
You can have all sorts of things in young adult.
Interesting. Okay. What? How did you do your research for this book?
Well, first of all, I just thought about all the things that I know. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I've written a ton of blogs. So I read through some of my blogs. But the main thing I did, because I have a lot of just knowledge in my brain, is to constantly be checking back with Palestinian colleagues. Do I have this right? Is this how it would be? How long does it, you know, I've been to the West Bank a ton of times, but do I know how long it takes to get from point A to point B? Or I've been to East Jerusalem, to the wall a million times, but, you know, where exactly was the women's section? You know, I mean, I kept checking back with people and also with some Israeli friends. Do I have, you know, do I have Tel Aviv right? Do I have this beach right? So a lot of it was checking back, checking back, checking back. And then when I get to a place, I have a very dear friend who grew up in Hebron, who actually lives in the U.S. now. So she was my like guardian angel to be sure I got the details right, that, you know, the name of the drum that the brother plays is the right name. You know, I kept making sure, because I'm an old white Jewish lady. I know a lot, but I don't. It's not my culture. So I have to be really careful that I get it right and I get the words right and I get the scene right. And I, you know, I get how they get their tomatoes right. And, you know, so I did a lot of checking in with the people who actually know this stuff from personal lived experience. The other thing is that because I was a gynecologist, I dealt with a lot of teenagers. I dealt with teenagers who've had trauma. So I have a sort of intrinsic knowledge of teenage trauma. I had a teenager twice. So I know a lot about how that works and what teenagers think. And in my critique group, several of this critique group, the women are 20 years younger than me. And so there's some teenagers around. So they also validated my teenagerness. And then I had some teenagers read the book, which is a hard thing to get a teenager to read a book. And unfortunately, you know, the feedback was, no, it's good. You know, it was like, hello, you know, yeah, it's okay, fine. I thought it was good. You know, that was like a teenage response. So I figured, well, it's not terrible. You know, they read it.
That's funny.
So I did that too.
Got it. Can we review? I know you already said that, explained this somewhat, but can we talk for a moment about your decision making around Melody's father, artistic decision making, but political artistic around her father, the non-Jewish, the Jewish, and the secular and also the ignorance about Israel-Palestine.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Why you made her as ignorant as she is, why you made her, quote-unquote, half-Jewish. I know you brought this up earlier, but can we go over it again?
So I needed to have characters that would end up in Israel-Palestine. So that meant that Melody had to have some Jewish connection, which was through her mother's sister who made Aliyah. It was through her father being an archaeologist and having a paper accepted in Jerusalem. So that was the method that I got her there. And then I got her interacting with, you know, Aaron wandering by text message and him falling in love with her in East Jerusalem, and then her having to visit the cousins and all sorts of things happen, you know. And so it was a tactic to be sure there was a reason that they got there. Most teenagers are completely ignorant about Palestine. And so that was no problem. That's like how people are. You know, and got I think that at this point in history, the teenagers who think they know something are religious Jews and Christian Zionist teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed someone to represent, you know, a nice, decent kid. No one's evil in this, you know, even the cousins who, you know, some terrible things happen. They're decent people. I needed someone to represent the sort of what teenagers know about Israel.
Yes.
And that had to be, for me, a religious kid, because I don't think other kids have an opinion. So that's
That's interesting. That makes sense.
But I needed to have a real reason. Why would they end up there? You know, why don't her father take her to, you know, Somalia? I needed to have a reason why I was picking this place.
I was moved by the relationship she had with Malka and that her mother had with Malka's mother. I don't know if Malka's mother comes into the story.
I mean, she's peripheral because she just appears at the beginning with the dinner at their house. I mean, she's a, you know, a lady who in 67, you know, got religion and went to Israel to make Aliyah and, you know, settled there and has her kids and, you know.
Right. But that chasm.
Right.
Spiritual chasm between Malka and Melody. Is one that any American Jew who's gone over there and met close friends or family can relate to.
Absolutely.
It's sort of like, wait, this is our family. They've made very different choices than we've made.
That's
they're on a
typical.
Different path.
Pretty typical.
Well, you say
Melody is also, she's like, you know, a big environmentalist. She's against armies. And here she has cousins who are in the army. You know, she just like, it's a disconnect for her that I wanted to show.
You say pretty typical, but I think that you do it very well and that it has a vivid and cutting quality and very familiar and dead on.
Yeah, and I did things that, you know, people may miss, but like the meal that the aunt makes for her, that she says is really great Israeli food is largely Arabic food, you know. So I'm playing with the tropes that, you know, probably just goes by people, but has meaning to it.
Great. Thank you. I think I might have missed that, although. So, Alice, let's step outside the book now a little bit. And what do you – is this book – you're a very political person, an intentional person. What is the political – what is the political intention of this book? What do you want to – where do you want this book to go? Who do you want to read it? And et cetera.
So, I have spent my life talking very much to the choir. I mean, sometimes I get beyond the choir, but mostly I'm in some variant of the choir. There may be people that are yelling at me, but mostly it's people who agree with me or I'm making them uncomfortable, but they're willing to sit through it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So my goal with this book was to get out of the choir.
Okay.
So I, you know, in my wildest fantasy, this book is part of curricula in high schools that deal with the Middle East, that deal with personal narrative, that deal with trauma, that deal with, you know, Jewish study, whatever category it can fall into. I think it's a good book for that category. So in that way, you know, as I've learned more about young adult literature, you know, young adults don't buy books. Their mothers and fathers buy books, their teachers, their librarians. So it's a weird marketing thing where you're selling to the people who buy the books, but you're trying to get the people who read the books interested. So,
interesting.
You know, I'm doing a lot of public events and readings that will get mostly adults because that's who comes to these things, but they're the ones who are going to buy the book. But I also need to get into schools and libraries. So that is a big wall to cross over. So, you know, I've applied to talk at the American Library Association. I've made myself available to the Seattle Public Libraries and to the King County Libraries. And I'll tell you, librarians are not calling me to say, oh, I want to have a controversial book about, you know, it's an uphill battle. So I am trying to interest people through the world of multiculturalism, through faith-based youth groups. I'm going to talk to a bar mitzvah class in a couple of weeks. You know, I'm trying to find ways that I can get a population that are teenagers that have to be there for some reason. And oops, here's an author who's going to talk about
it. Wow. Great.
And it's a big struggle because if you think about it, there's very, 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 very little YA literature on Palestine or sympathetic to Palestine. And when teachers or librarians do occasionally bring up a book, there's often tremendous pushback. Teachers have been doxxed. They've lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. They've been challenged. Mm-hmm. By, you know, Zionist Organization of America or ADL or whatever it is. There's a huge, you know, industry monitoring all speech on Palestine and on Israel. Yes. And so if that group notices this book and understands that it's an Israel-Palestine book, then, you know, there's going to be even more pushback. Right now, you know, it's only been out a couple of months and it's under the radar, which is both good and bad. You know, it may be under the radar because no one's reading it. But, you know, I'm working on getting it beyond the radar. And so that's the real challenge. But I see it as a way to talk with kids because, you know, they're part of the world and they form opinions and they're learning about, or except in places like Florida, you know, settler colonialism or Native American history. And I think this should just be part of that world. I don't want it to be exceptionalized. I want it to be, you're studying immigrants, you're studying refugees, you're studying war. Plop, there goes my book. So I'm hoping that it sneaks in that way and becomes just part of the conversation, is normalized, that it's okay to talk about Palestine without getting your head cut off. And that's going to take a lot of support and bravery and work from teachers and librarians. And I'm actually involved in a project with Nora Lester Murad, who you highlighted in Mondo Weiss, who has also written a young adult book called Chayda in the Middle. And we are interviewing teachers and librarians about their experiences, which are pretty stunning, and developing a resource and guideline list for teachers who do teach Palestine and who then get accused of anti-Semitism, like what to do about that and what is anti-Semitism and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of ways that this is working in terms of political organizing and education. But the big challenge is, how do I get this into schools as part of the curriculum? And that's really hard. I'm also working with a group called New Storytelling Advocates, I think is the name, who do, you know, conferences with kids, writing conferences, that kind of thing.
Wow.
And they're going to use my book as a mentor book. So, you know, I'm playing all the places that I can find, but it's an uphill battle.
Got it. Although, to be clear, it's an uphill battle for many authors in any genre,
absolutely.
Right? Yes.
I mean,
okay.
The budget from my publisher for marketing is about 5 cents, and that's how marketing
is.
Got it.
So, okay. Alice, can you be, you mentioned that you've already done some events speaking this, that, and the other. Have you had any political encounters in that, in those events so far?
No.
Okay.
You know, in Seattle, I had 50 people. In Brooklyn,
wow, great.
I had 100 people. Very positive reception.
Receptive. But,
yeah, because it's
beautiful.
It's stealth, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the story is enchanting, and you know, it can be dealt with strictly on its on certain terms. Well, what? So, As we wind down, I have a few more questions. One of them is, but before we get into the larger picture of the discourse, which, of course, you just addressed, I want to ask you, tell me what is wrong with, because I think there, well, just tell me what is wrong and what is right about speaking to the choir. Is there anything right about speaking to the choir?
Oh, absolutely.
Why? Tell me.
It's right to speak to the choir because the choir can always learn more. And I learn from speaking to the choir.
Okay.
I learn where they're at and they learn where I'm at.
Okay.
And so it's always important to speak to the choir.
Okay.
It's important to build their resilience. I mean, people in the choir get tired and drop out and blah, blah, blah. It's important to find all the intersectional ways that the choir can deal with other choirs. So we're all in a bigger choir. And, you know, I mean, the choir has changed over the last 25
years.
Yes. You know, at the beginning when we did this work and, you know, we're debating whether we could use the word Palestine in our name, it was just like a bunch of agonized Jews and a couple of Palestinians. And now it's like Black Lives Matter and First Nations and blah, blah, blah. So the choir has broadened enormously. And that comes from continually speaking with the choir. So choir is perfect.
Interesting.
Speaking beyond the choir is critical because if the movement doesn't grow beyond the choir, then it withers and dies. So
yeah.
Both are important.
Okay, that's a great answer. Helpful. Thank you. What about, so in the last part?
Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
Also, the choir has friends that are not in the choir. And just like, you know, gay marriage became okay because partly it was about love and everybody knew someone who was gay. So I want everybody to know someone who's questioning Israeli policy and have to grapple with that. Mm-hmm. And I want the person who is questioning to feel brave enough to talk to their friends. So, you know, there's also the subversive element as well.
Wow. So are we winning? You just mentioned a little while ago how much the scene of activism has dramatically shifted just over since I've met you, and the sort of the small and almost frightened circle that we were in then compared to now, in part thanks to the intersectional issues that you raised. So you've already mentioned that, but I guess in a larger how do you feel? How optimistic do you feel about this movement right now? And also the political dimension of it, if you're to the degree that you're engaged in that, the sort of.
So, you know, I am pessimistically optimistic.
Okay.
I think we're winning and we're losing at the same time. We're winning because the younger generation in this country is very different than their parents and their grandparents in many instances on this topic. And so there's a much broader analysis and questioning and a different vocabulary. You can use the word apartheid and no one chops off your head, or very few people chop off your head. So in that way, it's a much broader movement now, and it's not exceptionalized. It's within a broader intersectional movement for justice and social justice and against militarism and all that kind of stuff. Things that were unspeakable are now, you can see it even in the New York Times, which is my measure of where we're at. And, you know, there are, you know, reporters for the New York Times that are not Jewish Americans who live in Israel and have sons in the IDF. So we're making a little bit of progress there. We're losing in that there is a massive right-wing pushback in this country and globally, and as you know, in Israel, which I think is a measure of the fact that we were starting to have some inroads. You know, the pushback against the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, the pushback using the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, which includes any criticism of Israel, which, you know, was adopted by the U.S. State Department. So that's, and, you know, what, 35 states or something like that? So that's highly problematic. And if you look at life for Gazans, life for people in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, life is worse. Life is harder. You know, people in Gaza live under a crushing siege. Hamas and the PA have gotten nowhere, and Palestinian leadership is bankrupt. you know, drones hover over Gaza all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the Israelis repeatedly bomb them at will. And mm-hmm. I'm just worried, since Netanyahu's been backed into a corner, that he's going to have to start another war in Gaza, which is what he usually does. Things are terrible. And in the West Bank, things are terrible. The settler movement is growing. You know, the people that are the most right-wing fascistic people who, you know, like Smotrich and whatever the guys, Ben-Gavir, you know, who couldn't serve in the army because they were so right-wing, are now in charge of security. I mean, this is catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's also catastrophic is that although hundreds of thousands of liberal Zionist Israelis are marching in the streets for democracy, they seem to not have noticed that there is no democracy for Palestinians with Israeli citizenship and for Palestinians in the occupied territory. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things are better and things are terrible. And so, you know, when you look at, you know, Biden's relationship to Israel-Palestine is abominable. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going to happen with Saudi Arabia and China and some other big players? I mean, U.S. hegemony is shrinking, and we can't know what that's going to look like. So yes and no is my answer. But it doesn't mean you should stop trying.
And what about the local politics of it? Do you see positive changes? I'm feeding the witness here. Do you see any positive changes in your community, among your political representatives, or your media? Are you at all heartened by those changes?
Well, you know, we have Camilla Jayapal. She's not my rep, but she's next door. You know, people like that give me some hope, but there's still a minority in our completely dysfunctional Congress. You know, my reps are completely not in the program, as far as I can tell. You know, I've met with Adam Smith a number of times, not very positive experience. There is, you know, I've only lived in Seattle for about 8 years, so I'm just, and you know, three of them were a pandemic when I didn't leave my house. So I'm just sort of beginning to understand the lay of the land here. And there are a bunch of different groups that are working on this that I'm getting to know and, you know, speaking at and that kind of stuff. I think Jewish Voice for Peace has been very good at creating a space for anti-Zionist Jews and is really trying, you know, through their 501c4 to have political action moments. So those are all very good things. And, you know, we're the side of the country that had unions that wouldn't let the Israeli owned ship dock.
Right.
And
yes.
You know. So these are good things.
Yes.
So, you know, we creep along and we do the best we can. It's not overwhelmingly positive, victorious yet.
Got it. Alice, what did you just mention? Somebody Smith? I just wanted to.
Oh, Adam Smith. He's my rep.
Oh, he is. Okay.
In the U.S. Congress. Yeah.
Okay. Last question, because we're up against the hour. This has been a delight, but just to be another specific buttonhole, let's say that you ran into Pramila Jayapal, and she said at some event, I am for a two-state solution, when someone was questioning her about this. And what would you say to her if you were having coffee with her about that messaging, which is all through the Democratic Party, including from Bernie Sanders. And
So
what's your answer?
My answer very briefly is that the two-state solution devised at Oslo may or may not have been a good idea then. But at this point in history, if you look at the realities on the ground, the growth of settlements, the growth of Israeli takeover of the Jordan Valley, Area C, the declaration that East Jerusalem is the eternal undivided capital of Jerusalem. All those kind of maneuvers point to the fact that the two-state solution has died a miserable and sad little death. And that what we have in actuality is Israeli control from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River in various ways. And so we have a one state, but it's an apartheid state. And so the struggle right now is not to create a two-state solution. The struggle is to create one democratic state that allows all of the citizens to have a viable level of existence without persecuting each other. So for me, it's a civil rights struggle. It's an anti-apartheid struggle. It's a human rights struggle. But the two-state solution is quite, quite dead. And I think the Israeli government is certainly saying that for their own particular reasons. Lots of Palestinians are saying that. So I think that that's the direction we're moving in. And to hold on to the two-state solution is to hold on to something that is no longer even a viable possibility.
Hmm. Wow, great answer. Very concise and helpful. Okay.
We have to leave it there. But I encourage you to read Finding Melody Sullivan and share it with members of your family. It is now available in local bookstores. Alice Rothschild, Finding Melody Sullivan. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can also stream us live every Friday morning at KKRN.org. That's KKRN.org at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people.